Okay, thank you very much, Andy, for Andy's Corner. I look forward to next Sunday night when we will continue on to the QST article. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. And if you have any other questions or comments or topics you would like to add to tonight's TechNet, please give me your first name and your call sign.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
K2GJE, Ed. It may be a topic for another night, but if we have an antenna that for some reason is not cut properly, we have a good transmission line, we have a decent transmitter, and we put an SWR meter in the line, and it shows us some return loss. That isn't the whole picture, as far as I understand. That return watts goes back up the line. Of course, it's lost again by the loss of the line. And that's an ongoing situation. Is there any answer what happens at the end? Over.
Well, I would assume it's very much like the standing wave phenomena of antennas themselves. The waves reflect back and forth and back and forth, and ultimately a good portion of them, it depends upon the attenuation loss of the cable. A lot of them are lost as heat loss. Some of them are lost as radiative losses, and that's how RF gets into our shack.
H-G-J-E. But that loss is going up and down, yes. There is some loss on the line, but it's never lost. The first cycle, it comes back quite strong, and then it goes back down the line where it loses something again, and then it goes back up the line and loses something again. But this is an ongoing process. I don't think there's a total loss. I don't think if there's, let's say, even half the power coming down the line, that that's totally lost. Over.
Well, Ed, I would agree with you using a non-existent theoretical transmission line that had no inherent insertion loss. I think what we're trying to get at is that there is an inherent transmission line loss, both radiative and heat resistive, for every trip back and forth on the coax. So the more power is reflected, the more times it bounces back and forth. I agree with you that if the transmission line itself was completely lossless, eventually all of the RF would get back to the radiating antenna and you would have negligible losses. But all the transmission lines do have an insertion loss. So I think that's what's going on. It's not just the insertion loss on the first transmission, but on the repeated bounces back and forth as it sets up standing waves on the transmission line itself.
WY2U with a comment.
Yes, Mike.
Yeah, if I could there, I think we need to discuss two different situations, though, believe it or not, there, Roy and Ed. Ed, you are describing the situation where you have a reflective device at the output of the transmitter known as an antenna tuner or a matching device. Can I get into that a little bit? And I'm going to discuss the other situation which happens without a matching device. So if I could have it there, Roy, for a couple of seconds, let me see if I can try an explanation.
Certainly, Mike, please feel free. I was thinking in terms of no impedance matching circuitry, but okay, you can tell us.
Okay, very good. That's not the case that Ed was describing. Ed, consider a transmitter. Your block diagram, which has a transmitter, no matching device, a 50 ohm output design transmitter, looking into an SWR meter, directional coupler, with a transmission line of some length connected to the antenna. And let's assume the antenna is not matched to the transmission line so that reflections take place, okay? So, now, since you do not have a matching device, the transmitter is 50 ohms, the cable is 50 ohms, the antenna is not, you key the transmitter, T equals zero, you send energy down the coaxial cable. Sometime later, due to time delay, the velocity of propagation in the cable is, you know, somewhat in the vicinity of two-thirds, perhaps, of the velocity of light in space. Energy reaches the antenna. Some energy gets radiated because the antenna does have some radiation resistance properties, so some of the energy will get radiated by the antenna, but because you have standing waves, depending on what the magnitude of the standing waves is, some energy gets reflected back through the transmission line, through its associated losses, and back into the transmitter, where you have no matching device, therefore it is dissipated as heat in the final stage of the transmitter for this particular case. Of course, that's a bit now unusual in that sometimes the transmitter is not considered as a source in series with a 50-ohm resistor. It is more like a current source, an ideal current source, but still in all, energy is going to get dissipated as heat in the final stage because there is no matching device to redirect it. Ed, did I explain that good enough so far?
K2GJE, could I say something?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Gotcha, 100%. If it's an old-fashioned tube transmitter, it turns the plate red. If it's a solid-state transmitter, it puts too much voltage on the output transistor, and the circuitry cuts back. All great so far. Now, what happens if we throw the antenna tuner in there? Over.
Okay, now you have an entirely different situation. The antenna tuner is going to go... well, let me ask you, where do you want the antenna tuner to go? Before the VSWR meter or after the VSWR meter? So, or does it matter for this explanation there, Ed? Which would you like to discuss?
K2GJE. To really have a good explanation, we need two SWR meters. We need one SWR meter between the transmitter and the antenna tuner. That we're going to adjust the antenna tuner so that the line between the transmitter and the antenna tuner has a one-to-one. Then we need another SWR meter between the antenna tuner and the antenna. Okay? Take that over.
Okay, I'm glad you said that, because the first one, the SWR meter number one, the one that goes between the transmitter and the, antenna tuner is going to go directly after the, let me try this again. The SWR meter number one, is going to be right behind the antenna, and it is going to go before the antenna tuner. And what you said correctly is you're going to carefully try to match the antenna tuning device so that that always reads a one-to-one. In other words, whatever you're doing at the load end through the cable and all of that is going to be matched so that that SWR meter always reads one-to-one. After we said that, we can now forget it, and we'll forget that that one is even in line. Now let's talk SWR meter number two, which is going to be after the antenna tuner. Let me drop. Okay, so you carefully match the transmitter. SWR meter number one, as you noted before, is reading a one-to-one VSWR. You're now going to key the transmitter. Let's call the time that you key it T equals zero. And you're going to look at the SWR meter number two. If it has a fast enough response, it is going to read initially, but a couple of microseconds later, after a round-trip cable delay up to the antenna and back, it'll have a forward power reading and it'll have a reflected power reading. The power delivered to the antenna is going to be radiated. Well, let's put a number out. Let's make it a 5.5 to 1 SWR, because I happen to know what that number would be. Now, if the cable has no loss, which would be the ideal situation, if you had a perfectly lossless cable, let me drop. Initially, at T equals 0, you're going to try to send 100 watts of power up to the antenna. The antenna is going to try to receive the 100 watts full power from the transmitter. Since it's a 5.5 to 1 mismatch, only a portion of that power initially is going to get radiated. What cannot be radiated is going to be sent back to the, through the cable. Sometime later, after a reverse time delay, the power that is reflected gets redirected by the antenna tuner back up to the cable. And again, what can be radiated gets radiated. What cannot be radiated gets sent back through the cable. And after multiple up and down trips through the cable, eventually steady state conditions or convergence is going to be realized. And believe it or not, for the condition we just described for the lossless cable, your antenna efficiency is going to be 100%, and 100 watts will get radiated by the antenna since there's no loss in the cable. How does that sound so far, Ed? Back to you. WY to you.
K2GJE, very good. Got it. If we had an ideal lossless transmission line, and even if we used some open wire line, it probably would work very well. We'd radiate most of that power. What the problem is, most of us nowadays are not using open wire lines. We're using coax. And based upon how long the coax is and the quality of the coax, every time up and down we're going to lose some. But if we had an ideal line, no loss on the line, but a bad antenna, we would radiate all of it. Am I getting it right? Over.
Yes, sir, you're getting it correctly. That is correct. I'm trying to locate a spreadsheet that I did. Here it is right here. That is going to describe the conditions on the transmission line for a transmission line that is lossy. Let's consider my example. The antenna VSWR is 5.5, okay? And let's put a fairly decent piece of transmission line in the interface between the transmitter and the antenna, and let's say we can come up with a transmission line whose match power loss is 1 dB. Stand by 1 second. I want to put those numbers in the spreadsheet, and I'll talk the results to you. Stand by 1 second. Okay, so I put a match transmission line, a transmission line in between the VSWR meter and the antenna whose loss is 1 dB per 100 feet. I have 100 feet of transmission line, and I have an antenna load VSWR of 5.5. Okay, so at T equals 0, by the way, I've got a 100 watt transmitter. That's my example. I have a 100 watt transmitter. Now, going back to SWR meter number 1, it is always going to read 100 watts forward and 0 watts reflected because it is on the other side of the interface of the antenna tuner. So that's always going to read perfect, the full power coming out of the transmitter with no reflections. Now, it's going to take several passes up and down this cable before steady state conditions are finally realized. The first pass up the cable, if I had the ability to measure delivered power to the antenna load, and let's say I could put a watt meter up at the antenna side, if I looked at what happens, one cable pass, or in this particular case, about 172 nanoseconds after I keyed the transmitter, I would see a load power of 41.36 watts. That's how much power gets delivered to the antenna. So the rest of it's going to get reflected back. Let me drop. that's not the end of the story, because it's going to travel back through the cable again, and 172.2 nanoseconds later, it's going to see the reflected device called the antenna tuner, and it is going to get redirected back up through the cable again through a 1 dB loss. So now the power at the antenna is going to read 53.87 watts, somewhat more than the first pass. You get the idea. So that's, again, 53.87 watts gets sent to the antenna. The rest of it gets directed back through the cable, through the 1 dB loss, back through the 100 feet. Sees the antenna tuner, and now another 172 nanoseconds later, it gets re-reflected, and the third pass up the cable is 57.65 watts. Let me drop. Okay, I'm not going to go through every pass, but finally, if you wait long enough, and it looks like through nine passes up the cable, steady-state conditions approximately are met. The antenna is radiating 59 watts. 41 watts is going to be read on the watt meter. Now, you're not going to see all of these passes up and down the cable lead because the response of the directional watt meter is nowhere near fast enough. It can't respond in 170 nanoseconds. But it will respond steady-state. And it'll see, if you had a watt meter up at the antenna, you would see 59 watts radiated, 41 watts reflected. After steady state, and that's after nine passes up and down the cable. Wow, did that make sense, Ed? WI to you.
That makes a lot of sense. So the end result of all the reflections going up and down and the losses on the line going up and coming back down will have about maybe roughly 60 watts or 100 watts being radiated and 40 watts... Well, it's not really lost, but it's lost on the line. Very good. I give you a cigar. Over.
Ah, when I used to smoke, I would have taken you up on that. Thank you very much. The total line loss, by the way, for this whole system works out to be 2.27 dB. But remember, it started out as a matched line loss of 1 dB. So the additional losses due to the mismatched antenna turn out to be another additional 1.27 dB. And, of course, things get a lot worse as the antenna is more mismatched than what I showed. For example, if I put a 15-to-1 VSWR antenna on the same coax, well, now the total line losses are 4.44 dB. 36 watts gets radiated, 64 watts comes back as reflections, and that takes 12 passes up and down the cable. But you get the idea. Okay, back to that, WI2U. Thanks a lot for the time, Roy.
You're welcome, Mike. Thanks a lot. That was a very good explanation. You also have to keep in mind that real life is even messier than that. Real cables do have loss, attenuation losses, but also antenna tuners, other than the ones maybe made by JPL for billions of dollars, have a significant loss as well.
Yeah, indeed so. This spreadsheet that I generated allows you to put losses in anywhere in the system, but I didn't consider losses in the antenna matching circuit. Typically, they're probably under a half a dB, usually, the well-designed ones are anyway, because if you're putting out high power into a lossy antenna tuner, the antenna tuner itself is going to dissipate a lot of heat. So I would hope a well-designed one is less than half a dB, but again, you have to consider that in your power budget indeed. You're quite correct.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that we can't buy theoretical devices because that would be loads of fun and save us a lot of trouble. But once again, Mike, thank you very much for your explanation of the attenuation losses due to repeated reflections of mismatched power transmission lines.
Yeah, and Ed, just keep in mind, I put in a fairly decent transmission line, a fairly decent piece of coax, which has a total loss of 1 dB. Obviously, when the mismatch at the antenna is much higher than 1-to-1, the losses run significantly higher than 1 dB. So, again, but what you said before was correct. Using better transmission line, like open wire line or even 450-ohm window line, can certainly improve things. But coax has its uses, as long as the loads aren't too severely mismatched from the coaxial cable. Okay, I'm going to stand by and give it back to Ned. Thank you, Wolf. WY2U.
AC2GS. Well, thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it. Also, you know, keep in mind that one of the reasons why open line can be very popular is you can run a relatively lossless transmission open line with the antenna tuner in your shack, as opposed to the best way of dealing with coax, if you can do it, is an external antenna tuner at the base of the antenna itself, so that the attenuation losses from the reflection of the coax is not that much of a problem. That's why you have people who use doublets, you know, untuned dipoles connected via open line, so that the high viswa before the antenna tuner does its magic doesn't really impact reflection attenuation losses. So, very good topic. Anyone with any comments, questions, answers, statements, reputations, please.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
I guess the end result, if you're using an antenna tuner, you really should have a good quality antenna tuner. Where I worked, we had an antenna tuner that used vacuum capacitors, and they're very good quality, and I believe the rotary inductors were silver plated, so that helped. And the feed line between the antenna tuner and the antenna was very, very short, so that helped. And the end result is to cut the antenna to the frequency, or play around with it, cut the antenna length so that it suits the frequency, but being hams, we're all over every band. So thanks for the help, thanks for the information. I'll say good night. K2GJE, over.
Okay, Ed, thank you for the question and participating tonight. Yeah, in a perfect world, once again, it would be best to use only resonance radiating antennas, something that presents a nominal 50 ohms and there's no reflection across the transmission lines and you don't have to worry about losses via that or insertion losses of other devices. But again, we don't live in a perfect world. You can decrease the Q and increase the bandwidth of a given radiating antenna and give you a little bit of a wiggle room, but it only goes so far, and we're greedy people. We want multi-bands, we want wide-band radiators, and so a lot of people throw antenna tuners into the mix, and antenna tuners are incredibly, incredibly useful. You know, I joke that my Palomar antenna tuner I can tune a doorknob with. And on the flip side, though, you can find some guys, a lot of guys on HF, who tell you that you're kidding yourself, that antenna tuners only only trick your transmitter into not enabling the safety mechanisms, but that's not the whole picture. And thankfully, Mike offered us more insight into what's really going on with an effective antenna tuner of shifting the phase and reversing the wave back towards the antenna. Once again, this is AC2GS. I am the net control operator for the Limewark Technical Net. If you have any questions of a technical nature or a scientific nature, or if you want to talk about COVID, whatever you want to talk about, we're open for business here.
K2GJ, one last question.
Yes, Ed, certainly.
I wonder if there's a place on the internet where there's a program where you can plug in the SWR, the line loss, and the power, and come up with all his answers. Over.
I would be willing to bet, and I'm not a betting man, that there are more than a few web-based spreadsheets that allow you to do that. I'm sure there are nomograms, because I've seen a load of nomograms. When I get a chance, I will thumb through the internet and see if there's a calculator that you can just plug in the values. And if I find such a thing, Ed, I will email it to you, and I will put it on the link page, roy.ac2gs.com, so that others can avail themselves of it.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I just wanted to mention that on the Smith chart, they have these radially scaled parameters. On the right side, there are a number of lost parameters. Frankly, I'm not too sure how to use some of them, but there is one that is labeled SWR loss constant. I think that takes this into account. Go ahead.
Okay, that's interesting. I've tried repeatedly to figure out a way to explain Smith charts to the average person reasonably well and not come quite across. So, you know, once I have to start talking about normalization, I lose too many people. But that's interesting. I have to look into that. You know, there's a lot of stuff that is not obvious on a Smith chart. And most presentations of Smith charts pretty much deal with meat and potatoes. They don't go into the outer aspects of some of the things that you can do with that interesting graph.
Yeah, there are quite a few of these radially scaled parameters. I know, like when I'm looking at one now on the left side, they have one that's pretty obvious, the SWR reflection coefficient. But on the right side, they have for the lossy transmission lines, they have one that's calibrated in attenuation 1 dB per major division, and a couple of other ones. And I haven't seen any literature on how to use those ones on the right side. I've seen some literature on the SWR and the return loss and other ones on the left, but I haven't seen too much on for the right side scale parameters.
Okay, I don't recall seeing anything like that on things like YouTube and such. I'll have to do a deep dive and see if I can find anything on that subject. I think generally people are less intimidated by a spreadsheet or a web calculation form where you just put in a couple of numbers. Most people tend to get very nervous when they see a Smith chart for the first, tenth, or hundredth time.
AFCP was a question.
Yes, what is your question?
I would like to know if anybody knows if silver mica disease occurs in battery-powered transistor radios. I know it occurs in, you know, the plug-into-the-wall 250-volt plate supply kind of radios, but I wonder if it occurs in transistor radios.
Okay, anyone out there with an answer for the gentleman? Well, it seems no one has an answer for you. I have something else I need to Google sometime this week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
K2TAS with a question.
Yes, K2TAS. What's your question?
First of all, good evening, guys. It's nice to hear you guys talking in a really interesting conversation and good explanations. My question is, I'm interested in doing summits on the air activation, specifically on HF. Is there any benefit? I know with VHF and UHF, the height is might, so you always have that benefit in line-of-sight communication, but is there much of a benefit to elevation, specifically elevations of, you know, mountain-size elevations with HF when transmitting on HF frequencies versus off of sea level?
Well, it sort of depends on what kind of antenna you're working with. Some are very sensitive to elevation, others not so much. Certainly one of the most obvious that doesn't really get anywhere particularly extra with elevation is something like a magnetic loop. They're really just shortened dipoles. They tend to work best when they're about 10 feet above ground, so raising them higher doesn't seem to benefit much. Verticals. The only benefit of elevating a vertical, for the most part, is getting it away from ground coupling. It requires less radials. But for all intents and purposes, you can smack a vertical on a flat piece of land, and if it has good radial systems, it has a wonderful takeoff angle and should do well. When you get to things like dipoles and horizontal antennas, that's when you have a problem. If you don't bring it up to a proper elevation, you will get ground coupling, which will give you loss, and reflective problems in which your radiating angle will tend to be more straight up. You'll get a near vertical incident sky wave. So if you're working with a vertical, it's immaterial. If you're working with a dipole or anything that's vaguely horizontal in that way, height is very, very helpful.
All right. I guess that leads to a sub question, which is if I'm working with a dipole, and I understand that the antenna should be about half or a quarter wavelength above the ground, ideally. When we talk about that distance above the ground, would I be using the ground that's under my feet as the guideline, or would I be using sea level as a guideline for that?
That is a good question, and unfortunately, it's a complicated question. It really depends upon the material under your feet. Usually, people ask that question, and it's much more easy in terms of apartment houses. Like, they'll go up to the roof, but they'll say, you know, it's not above the roof, it's planted straight on the roof. Does that make any difference? And because of the quality of the material in most buildings, it doesn't really cause any particular problems. It depends upon whether the mountainous area is rocky or basically sand, if it's wet or dry. For all intents and purposes, I would assume that the average raised mountain gives you not quite the same as just a tower, but much better than flat ground.
Understood. All right, thanks so much for the explanation. This is K2TAS. I'll be on the side.
Okay, thanks for your participation. Anyone else with any comments on this particular subject?
K2CJE?
Yes, Ed.
CW. Isn't there a certain amount of... providing you got the antenna enough off the ground, a certain amount of line of sight radiation based upon the curvature of the Earth, and the rest ionosphere bounce over?
Well, I assume to a degree, but I don't know if that's fundamentally that beneficial. I have kind of read anecdotal stories of people who elevated their antenna with high hopes and didn't really get what they had expected. It has to do with the degree of the takeoff angle. If the takeoff angle is close enough to the horizon to benefit from propagation, that probably should be sufficient. That there is a diminishing return, as far as I understand, height of antennas, with the exception of line of sight type of radiators. There was a gentleman with a call that ended GW who I think wanted to say something.
Yeah, I was just curious. I haven't been able to work for a while, but. When I had a better sized piece of property, I had an OCF 10-mist dipole that was on about a 40 degree upward and downward angles, and has a 4-to-1 balance, and one other component, I still don't remember what it was, but I was able to keep in touch with most of the people up and down the coast of the seaboard, but at the same time, later on at night, mostly midwinter, I'd be able to converse with fellows out in Mainland and out in California and all over the country. And I've found Entis antennas to be most advantageous to HF operations on a local and national scale. I was just curious as to what your views on such as an R7000 pushcraft vertical, how they might operate and affect our operations locally.
Okay, I mean, offhand, I don't recall what the R7000 pushcraft looks like.
It's about 12 feet to 14 feet, 3 or 4 different loading coils, depending on what band you want to operate on, and built-in balance. Very expensive, and it was very nice. Actually, a Limark member that was deceased about 10 years ago, Mr. Sedula, he was communication out of Drummond, kind of gave it to me before he passed away. And I'll tell you, I had a ball.
Okay, I pulled it up on the internet. It looks like a multi-trap vertical. Is that kind of how you would describe it?
Yes, I concur.
Okay, you know, there are a lot of people who swear by multi-trap antennas. They just find that it works great for them. Unfortunately, other people that you talk to, inevitably the trap kind of, you know, little animals burrow in, insects and such, things short out, things open up, and antennas, usually the traps malfunction, and the bands that they cover gets less and less, and there's a little bit in the literature about the lossiness of traps, so... You know, as in all cases, if it works for people who have it, then more power to them. But trapped antennas do require a little bit more maintenance than other designs.
Roger that. Yeah, I found better results with that particular antenna off of the top of my RC coach. Than I have with the Envis, and I've had a great time with it. So, pushcraft, you know, as always, has great hands. They always have, and they make a good product. I was just checking into see what your view on that was. I mean, it is sealed, you know, completely with a. Liquid electrical tape, and I have yet to have a problem with it. That being said, I'll pass it back to the net, and thanks for the input, and to GW, Oyster Bay, New York.
Okay, thank you for participating tonight. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on. If anyone has any further questions or topics they would like to discuss, either technological, amateur radio, or science, or computers, or COVID. Whatever you want to talk about, I'm here tonight.
VDH with one comment.
Yes, John, certainly.
I just wanted to pass a few comments about something that was brought up last week, that Tesla valve. I think it was N2XJM brought it up. It's a fluid flow device, and apparently what it does, it maintains a laminar fluid flow in one direction, which has low turbulence and very low flow resistance, but in the reverse direction, it generates a lot of turbulent flow, and so it has a higher resistance. It's like, almost like a check valve, but it has no moving parts at all, right?
Yeah, John, you describe it very nicely. I put on my link page a link to the Tesla valve where they actually make one. I think it's out of a 3D printer. I'm not quite sure, and they demonstrate how it functions.
Yeah, I had to dig up my old fluid mechanics book to look at that turbulent flow and laminar flow. A couple of things that came back to mind from CE120 at City College. Hi. Good.
Yeah, fluid dynamics is a very complicated, interesting field of science. You know, you almost don't realize all the different subfields in hidden away in major topics, fluid dynamics.
Actually, I got my best understanding of all of that vector calculus with the gradients, divergence, and the curls, and all of that stuff. I got my best understanding of it from that fluid mechanics course. When I had my first E&M course, I didn't know what the hell was going on. But after that fluid mechanics course, the things like the curl and the divergence, they started to make a lot of sense. Go ahead.
Yes, Wesley, recognized. Well, you're not the only one. I have seen more than a few YouTubes where they use fluid dynamics as the metaphor to demonstrate divergence and curls. So it's being seen by tens of thousands of people, and I assume that they're having the same beneficial effect. Sometimes one particular metaphor works better than others. Wesley, what did you want to say?
Two things. There is a nice video explaining that. I sent you the link for it, but if you go to YouTube and you just put Tesla valve, the complete physics, that's the title of it, is going to pop out. Tesla valve, the complete physics on YouTube. And also to describe it, it is a fixed geometry, passive check valve. It allows fluid to flow preferentially in one direction without moving parts. The interior of the conduit is provided with enlargement, recess, projections, and baffles, or booklets, which were offering virtually no resistance to the passage of the fluid in one direction other than surface friction, considering the most of impassable barrier to its flow in the opposite direction. So practically, if you look at that design and you look at this booklet, you see that in the opposite direction, the cross-section, if you look at the cross-section of Tesla valve showing all of the cavities design, you see that in the opposite direction that the fluid flow is divided by two passages. One that is trying to go straight and the other one that it goes on a sort of booklet having a curvature, a sort of bubble, I would say, sort of bubble that actually takes that part of the stream and reverses it, and then at the end of it, the outflow meets the other straightly flowing part of the stream and opposes. So if you repeat 5-6 times the same structure, at the end of it you just have water dropping instead of water flowing in opposite direction. And to exchange.
Yes, Wesley. I posted that particular link onto my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. Anyone interested can just go to the page after the TechNet and look at the presentation. It's a very nice one. And it'll kind of, you know, as I always say, a video is worth 100,000 words. So, but you described it well as well, Wesley.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's try a puzzle. I don't know if anyone's up for it. I hope they are. It's a little math puzzle. It really doesn't require a pencil and paper. You can pretty much do it in your head. But listen closely to the puzzle. You have three guys. They go into a bar. It's their regular bar, and each of them has one drink. It's $10 a piece. They give the waiter $30. And the waiter brings it over to the boss cashier. The boss cashier looks at the three patrons and say, you know, those are great guys. They're three of our best customers. I'm feeling generous. He peels off $5 from the $30. He gives it to the waiter, and he says, give them back the $5 of that. The waiter, though, is a little annoyed that he didn't get tipped and a little annoyed that he has to do math, and so he doesn't bother with either. Instead of giving each person one-third of $5, he gives each person $1, and he pockets the $2 that's left over. So the three guys have now paid $27, $9 apiece. 9 times 3 is 27. The waiter has $2 in his pocket. That comes to 29. Where did the other dollar go? Does anyone want to play a math puzzle tonight, or does anyone want me to repeat the puzzle? They weren't paying attention the first time. I have no problem repeating it, but I don't know if anyone's game for the puzzle tonight. Could you repeat it? Yes, indeed. You have three patrons. They come into a bar. They each buy a drink that's $10 apiece. It comes to a total of $30. They hand $30 over to the waiter. Waiter takes it to his boss at the cashier. And the cashier boss says that these guys are his favorite customers, peels off $5 from that $30 that he got, gives it to the waiter, tells the waiter to give it back to the three gentlemen. The waiter doesn't want to do math, so instead of giving them $5 back, he gave $1 to each of the three guys and pocketed the remaining $2 for himself. So you have three guys who paid $9, so 3 times 9 is 27. You have the waiter who has $2 in his pocket, so it comes to $29. So the question is, where did that extra dollar go to?
AF2P, there is no extra dollar.
Care to expand upon that?
Yep, by the way, the name here is Ed Echo Delta. Yep, the money you came in was 30. The proprietor says, no, give him $5 back. So the waiter puts $2 in his pocket and gives $1 to each of the guys. That's the $5 that went back.
Okay. The bottom line is the way that I phrased the question kind of sets up a ridiculous equation. You're adding up losses and gains. You don't do that. You either add up the losses or add up the gains, and they have to equal. So what's really going on
is the loss is the $27, not $30, but the $27 that the three customers paid for their drinks. And the place that the $27 went is $2 of it went into the waiter's pocket, and $25 went into the cashier. So that's kind of the way this little puzzle works. It's a real legitimate puzzle. It's even on Wikipedia. I will post it. It's called the Missing Dollar Riddle. So thank you, Ed, for the answer. I hope some people listening found it amusing.
A comment?
Yes, John.
Oh, when you flow chart it out, it's obvious. But listening to the explanation throws you off.
Yes, indeed. It's a trick puzzle in that the way that it's phrased is almost guaranteed. If you're not listening closely, people tend to just go along with premises. So if you went along with the premise, you would be adding up gains and losses simultaneously, which doesn't work out anything. So yeah, if you deconstruct it yourself, then it's rather obvious. The problem is almost no one will deconstruct it themselves. They'll just go along with the question and then just kind of stare at you. Okay, so you've had the puzzle tonight. You've had a bunch of things. Once again, if anyone else has any questions of any topic and want to ask them, you are free to do so now. Just give me your first name and your call sign.
Hank in 1YDY.
Yes, Hank.
We were discussing how current flows on the outside of a conductor earlier in the evening with Andy, and I was thinking about the old isoloop antennas that had a large capacitor on the inside and a piece of aluminum that formed a circle. And somewhere I read, and I don't remember if it was ARRL or perhaps one of the other magazines that have since gone extinct, such as the 73, where they compared the isoloop version to the MFJ version that was made with circular tubing. Let me drop. And the comment was made in the article that because of skin effect, the flat metal of the isoloop version was a more effective radiator than the formed tubing of the MFJ version. And I was wondering if you could comment on why flat metal with skin effect and the sharp edges, I believe, have something to do with the flat metal might be a better radiator.
I assume that ultimately it simply meant that the surface area, because what happens is it travels effectively very, very close to the surface, skin deep into the surface. So for whatever geometrical pattern and any given type of conductor, the larger the surface area of the object, the more current that it can carry efficiently.
Okay, I seem to recall something about the edges having some type of radiational value, and I just can't recall what it was, but maybe it's just surface area. All right, thank you for your time, and 1YDY.
No problem. Thank you for participating tonight. Once again, anyone out there with any questions or comments or topics tonight for the TechNet?
Just a quick comment. This is Ray, November 2, Google Got Whiskey. Time to hit the hay. Have to get up early. May God bless and keep you all. And now that I'm back on the air on my little stinky station here, I'll catch you next week. Have a good night.
Okay, Ray, likewise, thank you for participating tonight. You know where we are, and we're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. for the most part, and you're more than welcome to join us again. So have a safe week, and hopefully we'll chat again next Sunday.
Limark Tech Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
Roger that. Thank you very much. And by the way, in regards to the two rigs, I don't remember Norris's call sign, but he's got a report. And again, especially regarding the two rigs, which are coming way back into play, given that man's choice to play God these days. There's nothing the guy can't fix, and one horse operation, the Norris Electronics, out of Bridgeport. So you guys all have a good night, and talk to Richie Stallman in my regards, and have a great night, guys. And to Zed, GW.
Okay, Ray. Have a good night. Have a safe week, and hopefully we'll chat again next Sunday. Once again, this is AC2GS Roy here, Net Control Operator for the Limark Technical Net. And if you have any kind of a question, this is a good time as ever any to ask it. So hit the push to talk and say peace. Okay. Once again, thank you for your participation, and hopefully you'll be back next week when we do this all over again. Well, let's go into science talk. Science has given us some very interesting news this past week. There have been a series of Nobel Prizes awarded, so I have a couple of articles on that subject. So I'll let it drop for a second, and then I'll start with that. Okay, three scientists who cemented the reality of black holes have been jointly awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. Roger Penrose of the University of Oxford, Reinhard Genzel of the Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics in Garching, Germany, and Andrea Ghez of the UCLA will split the prize. The Royal Swedish Academy of the Science announced October 6th. Black holes, which we've talked about before, are massive objects with a gravitational field so strong that nothing can escape once it falls within, not even light. At their center, black holes harbor a puzzling zone called a singularity, where the laws of physics cease to make any sense whatsoever. Penrose will receive half of the 10 million Swedish kroner prize, that's more than $1.1 million, for his mathematical calculations showing that black holes are physically possible. When the strange objects were first proposed as a consequence of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, scientists were skeptical that the black holes could actually exist. The other half of the prize will be split between Genzel, also of the University of California, Berkeley, and Ghez for their work, revealing that one of these dark objects lurks at the center of our very own galaxy, the Milky Way. This year's prize celebrates the discovery of one of the most exotic objects in the universe, said David Haviland, chair of the Nobel Committee for Physics, during the announcement. For many years, physicists questioned the very idea of a black hole, treating it as a peculiarity in our theory of gravity. Let me drop for a second. Penrose invented mathematical strategies to tackle the complexities of black holes. His work revealed that black holes, instead of just being mathematical artifacts of Einstein's theory, could form in conditions likely to exist in this universe. In 1965, he published a landmark paper in Physical Review Letters that describes how matter could collapse to form a black hole with a singularity at its center. Some of Penrose's insights came while walking in the woods. He recalled in a news conference on October 6th, quote, "I would think about these questions as I was walking, thinking about what it would be like to be in this situation with all this material collapsing around you and what would happen," end quote. Beginning in the 1990s, Ghez and Genzel each led teams that used telescopes to peer at the center of the Milky Way, measuring the orbits of stars that zip across the galaxy's heart. Cars move so fast, both teams found that only an incredibly compact massive objects such as a giant black hole could explain their trajectories. That work, which has continued in the decades since, helped solidify the existence of black holes and helped confirm the predictions of general relativity. Now, the Milky Way's central black hole is named Sagittarius A asterisk, is a behemoth at 4 million times the mass of the sun. Scientists now think that such a supermassive black hole fits